Accession number 30018, reel 18.
So Valley reel 18.
So yes, I had to go off to the States on the Sunday, and there seemed no reason to change my plans. There was nothing more the people at Dunsfold could do to help the Royal Navy, apart from the final preparations of the last airplane in the hangar and so on, and so I went off to the States as planned. And in the normal way in the States, you would live in a motel somewhere and go in and out to work at the airfield where you were. And in this particular occasion, I was living in a typical American motel, and I would come in the evening, turn on the television, and as the television went live, so you would see the latest news from the Falklands. Now, this was quite unlike what you guys had in the United Kingdom, because the Argentinians were feeding the CNNs and so on of this world and the ABCs with daily video footage that they had shot and they had approved and they had cleared, etc., etc. And it's fine. And so what sort of thing? And there was this period of sort of false calm while the ships, the task force steamed south. I mean, there was thick end of 2 weeks involved. They moved south, going slower and slower. Well, the hope was that the political side of things would be sorted out. Then it became clear that it was not going to be sorted out and fighting was going to happen. Well, I went back in one evening after that, and as I turned on the television, there was tonight's video footage, and it showed the wreckage of XZ-450 on the rocks. And I knew it was genuine. I knew it wasn't fake. I mean, I could recognise all sorts of things on the airplane and its registration number and so on. And the cameraman was panning around the wreckage of the reaction control system in the wingtip and so on. And I thought, oh dear, why that aeroplane? You know, because there was a sort of sentimental attachment to it. It was the first one we'd had. It was the first one we took to Farnborough. We ran out the ski jump at Farnborough, and I'd been flying it that Friday when the balloon went up and so on. Well, what I didn't realise at that time was that the loss of that aeroplane and its pilot, Nick Taylor, was absolutely instrumental in probably saving more lives than any other event that happened down in the Falklands. And you might say, what on earth do you mean by that? Well, XZ-450 had been our Sea Eagle trials aeroplane, and I mentioned in fact that I was flying it with two Sea Eagles on immediately before. It had, therefore, the full Sea Eagle weapon control panel in the cockpit. And I don't mean a mock-up test and experimental thing. I mean a proper production standard Sea Eagle control panel, night lighting the whole lot on it. So when the Argentinians got to the wreckage and they found this Sea Eagle control panel in the cockpit, they very reasonably thought that it was typical of all of the Sea Harriers. And so the Mamma Mia or whatever, you know, the fleet's got a Sea Eagle capability. And because of this, the aircraft carrier never left port, because they were afraid that it would just be sunk by Sea Eagles, which were a better piece of kit than Exocet, and because they were more modern. And we know how much damage Exocet did to our fleet. Belgrano wandered out, and we know what happened to that. So apart from that unhappy episode, the Argentinian Navy really didn't get in the fight. All the aircraft were launched from land bases, whether they were Navy aeroplanes or Air Force aeroplanes, and therefore they had the disadvantage of the extreme range they were having to operate at. Well, just imagine if 450 hadn't been shot down, if they hadn't suddenly found out misinformation, as it happens, that, you know, that they got this capability, then we could have seen the Argentinian Navy fighting the Royal Navy. And the Royal Navy would have been at a big disadvantage all that distance from home. The outcome could have been very, very different, and I'm quite sure many, many more lives would have been lost. So it's funny how things work out at times, isn't it? Mm.
What about the performance of the Sea Harrier in the Falklands? Because obviously you understood an awful lot about the aircraft, and you would have been fed back, I assume, some information about that, about the performance. Did it live up to expectations? What you thought, or was there anything new that was introduced that you may not?
No. It did everything that it said on the tin, you know, as far as we were concerned, and we were very pleased, because confident though we had been in the airplane's capabilities and its serviceability and all the rest of it, there is nothing like the real operational test of actually being used in war. So we were, to some extent, relieved that we hadn't oversold this piece of kit, and that our confidence had not been misplaced. Because it wasn't, and that was excellent.
Because I believe the Argentinians were quite fearful of the Sea Harrier as an aircraft to engage. Because obviously you've talked quite a lot about how pilots initially thought, British pilots thought initially about it not being supersonic and that. But as a fighter, it performed remarkably well, didn't it?
Yes, it did, and largely because it had. Not just the Sidewinder, but the AIM-9 Lima version, the L version, which had much better acquisition characteristics than the earlier version. Now, the AIM-9 Limas were provided by the United States quietly to our Royal Navy. We didn't have them when the war started, and they were a devastating piece of kit. I think the Argentinians lost the battle against the task force because they used the wrong tactics. This is just me now, but I've talked to other people and I've never had my views rubbished. The tactics of the Argentinian pilots were that they should ignore any Harriers that they came across and press on with their attacks. And by ignore, I mean don't drop your weapons in the sea and turn and fight. Try and outrun them or whatever and get on with your attack. If they had been briefed, if you see a Harrier, dump your weapons and fight the Harrier, I think we would have lost the war. Not because the Harrier was inferior to the airplanes they had, but it didn't have that much of an advantage, and we had 21 airplanes. They had 120 or 125. On a sheer attrition basis, they could have wiped out our Sea Harrier fleet over a week. And then they could have strolled about the air above the battle fleet with impunity. They would have had air supremacy, not just air superiority, air supremacy. And they could then have, in their own time, taken out our ships with conventional attacks, with missiles and with bombs. But they weren't briefed to fight like that. They were briefed the other way around, and I think that is probably one of the reasons that they lost the war.
At the time, I remember hearing of a tactic that was employed with the Sea Harrier, which was called viffing. Is that something that was employed, or to what extent, and did you have any knowledge of that?
Yes, indeed. Viffing is something that often gets raised in the context of the Falklands. Viffing, V-I-F-F, ing, stands for vectoring in forward flight. It means using the nozzle lever not to provide yourself with an ability to hover, but with an ability to point the engine in a slightly unusual position. Viffing was developed as a tactical manoeuvre by the United States Marine Corps. When we found out what they were doing, which was outside the structural envelope of the Harrier, because the Harrier's nozzle control system was designed to be used at no more than 250 knots. And if you stick those nozzles down into a 500 or 600 knot airflow, then the mechanism that is pushing them out into the airflow comes under great strain. And so we had to strengthen the operating chains and do other things to the linkage to make sure that we couldn't break the aeroplane if they were to wave the nozzle lever about in combat, they, the Marine Corps. Now, some people in the design office said, well, all you have to do is to put a prohibition on using the nozzle lever above 250 knots. I said, that won't work. You know, a combat pilot is going to do whatever a combat pilot can in order to win a combat. You've got to be realistic. We must make that nozzle lever marine proof. Well, by the time the Falklands happened, all this had all long been done. And so the Royal Navy pilots had the ability, if they wanted to VIF in a flight. But they didn't get into those sort of fights for the sort of reason I mentioned. And so VIFing was not a factor in the Falklands War.
Were there any lessons learned, obviously, from the operational use of the Harrier, the Sea Harrier down in the Falklands, back with yourselves at all?
I don't think the lessons were with Hawkers or British Aerospace, as it was by then, with the aircraft company. I think the lessons were all with the Royal Navy and the MOD. They realised what they needed was an airborne early warning radar aeroplane. It used to be the Gannet, when they were flying their Buccaneers and their Phantoms. So they had no radar cover that was, if you like, over the horizon looking at what was coming. All we had was what the ships had down on the surface, which is very limited in how far it can look, and what the Harriers themselves had. We badly needed an airborne early warning radar to manage the fight and the interceptions and so on. Bit like the chain home stations in the Battle of Britain, you know, they were fundamentally managing limited resources. Well, the Royal Navy pushed into service very quickly after the war a Sea King with a huge search water radar on in a sort of dustbin like device on an arm, but it wasn't there in time for the war. So I think that was the biggest thing. It's no good having fighters on board a ship if you haven't got some airborne early warning.
And what is your opinion of the role of the Harrier in the Falklands War? Do you believe it was a pivotal role that it played during the war?
Well, if you talk to the Admiral that led the whole thing, he said, without the Sea Harrier, we couldn't have sent the task force. And he meant by that, we would have had no air cover. None whatsoever. It isn't a case of whether the Harrier is good or bad at air cover. At least you had something. Without it, they could not have dared to send a task force.
After the war had finished, you were still chief test pilot for a period of time, weren't you? What were you involved in that period?
There were two things. There was the upcoming new version of the Sea Harrier, which became the FA-2. I had very little to do with that. It was after my time. And this was the improvement to the radar and improvement to other equipments in the aeroplane. And then there was the big program, which I was out in the States on during the Falklands War that I mentioned earlier, where we were doing this AV-8B, which then, for the Marine Corps, which was a big wing, big plastic wing, 230 square foot area instead of 201 square foot, lighter because it was made of carbon fibre, carbon epoxy material. There was this development programme, which was a considerable programme. The Royal Air Force had a version of that aeroplane called the GR-5, and then the GR-7, and then the GR-9. And these 5, 7, and 9 and the two-seater equivalents of the T-10 and the T-12 all have this big plastic wing. So that was going on, but my work finished at the end of, well, beginning of April 83 when I turned into a pumpkin when I became 50. By then, we were looking at an updated version of the Hunter two-seater to have this new radar that was going into the FA-2 version, a much better radar than the original one. The Hunter couldn't manage this radar. It was too much for it. And so we modified a Hawker Siddeley 125 aeroplane and put the radar in the front of that and had a lab in the back. And so that was the equivalent aeroplane that Taylor and others used to develop the FA-2 version of the aeroplane.
When you'd reach 50, is that, were the restrictions on you being a test pilot at that stage?
Yes, I mean, when... excuse me, yes, when I joined the company as a civilian test pilot, the mandatory retirement age was 45. That was the age at which the company said, thou shalt retire and take your pension and all the rest of it. When I got to be 45, I made the case for carrying on until I was 50, assuming I kept my medical standard, and I was able to succeed with that, but only... with agreeing that when I got to be 50 I wouldn't make a fuss again, sort of thing, and that I was quite happy to do. Colin Chandler was our MD at the time, now Sir Colin Chandler. He ran defence export sales after he left British Aerospace. He now is the chairman of EasyJet and so on. Wonderful guy, inspirational leader, and those people are few and far between. My definition of such a leader is that not only does he have these natural leadership qualities that we can all recognise, but he doesn't waste them by not talking to and accepting the advice of his staff, who are specialists in certain areas. Some inspirational leaders think they know it all and they don't want to listen to anybody else. Well, Colin Chandler wasn't one of those, or isn't one of those. So he said to me when I was negotiating with him to carry on to 50, there were two or three things I wanted, and he said yes to all of them. And I said, and he said, but when you get to be 50, I don't want you to make a fuss again. And I said, okay. And that was it.
What did you go on to do with the company after that period, John?
They made me general manager of the flight test site at Dunsfold for a few years. And then I got moved on to the headquarters at Kingston, where I spent my last 18 months or so before I was made redundant in 1990, because Kingston and Dunsfold were then shutting. And they wanted me to go to Wharton. I didn't want to go to Wharton for all sorts of personal reasons. And so I was made redundant. That was probably what I was angling for anyhow. But I went to Kingston for the last 18 months or so of my time with British Aerospace, and I was working on potential future uses of the aeroplanes that we were then manufacturing. And in particular, I was looking at Hawk being used as a NATO military training aeroplane, which eventually it was. So yes, I think my title was Special Operations Manager or something, some load of rubbish, you know, which is one of these non-dimensional titles that means nothing and allows you to get on with what you're supposed to be doing.
And have you kept your interest in aviation and work in the aviation field since?
Yes, I haven't stopped. I had 5 or 6 years as a self-employed test pilot after I left British Aerospace, and I work for 7 different organisations during that time and flew over 20 different types of aeroplane. Some of them were quite significant. I was the first Western test pilot invited by the Russians to evaluate the MiG-29.
Well, could you tell me about that?
Best fighter wing I've ever flown. Brilliant piece of kit. And that just about says it all. It was a wonderful flight. I flew with their chief test pilot in one of their two-seaters. And it was beautiful to see what really good aerodynamicists could do with a fighter wing. I'm not suggesting we didn't have really good aerodynamicists at Kingston, although I have to admit, and I think they would be the first to agree, that they were nothing like the calibre of the MiG-29 and Su-27 aerodynamicists for a whole variety of reasons. But the Kingston people also had terrible constraints on size and weight because of the engine that was available to lift this thing off vertically, and so they could never get to grips with a wing of the quality that the MiG-29 had. And when airplanes are flying normally and not on an engine, the wing determines, not surprisingly, how well they fly, and the Harrier's always been at a bit of a disadvantage with its wings. But the MiG-29 wing. Now, what do I mean by best fighter wing? You could take it to a higher angle of attack, and you could use the controls instinctively without the aeroplane biting you, stalling, spinning, going out of control, or departing, as the word is these days. When somebody says the aeroplane departed, they mean it departed from control. Whether it went through a stall or into a stall or into a spin is or a tumbling maneuver. The general term used is departure. Well, this MiG wing was as departure proof as you could imagine, and if you know how to do aerobatics in a tiger moth, and by that I mean you know which way you have to move your hands and feet to do a loop, a roll, a stall turn, then take my word for it, you could do it in the MiG-29. And I just did a stall turn as easily as if I'd been a tiger moth. And I had been an instructor at Cranwell on Jet Provost, and one go in five, I would mess up a stall turn in a Jet Provost. And you say to Bloggs, there you go, you see, Bloggs, that's what happens if you don't do this and that right. But no, I mean, the MiG-29 was just brilliant. So the aerodynamics was so benign from the pilot's point of view that you could just use the controls in a way that was totally unthinkable with United Kingdom or Western high-performance jets at that time. After the MiG thing, what other sort of airplanes are worth mentioning? The Israeli Levy, which was another very interesting airplane. This is one of four aircraft in the world that are the same aerodynamic configuration as Eurofighter, the current Typhoon. The Israelis were the first to experiment with this configuration. The Swedes were second with the Gripen, and the French were third with the Rafale, and the Eurofighter was fourth with the Typhoon. And I went out to Israel, I think it was 91. Anyhow, it was 10 days before the shooting started in the first Gulf War. And everybody thought I was crazy to go out there, but it was an opportunity to fly a really advanced aeroplane, which I wasn't going to turn down. And that I did. I flew the T-45 Goshawk, which was the McDonnell Douglas version of the Hawk for the United States Navy. I was asked to go to the States and look at that. The other end of the scale, I was flying aeroplanes like the CN-235, a civil and military transport aeroplane, like a twin-engine Hercules, about three-quarter scale Hercules, but with two engines, ramp at the back, you know, that sort of thing, high wing, couple of large turboprops. I was flying the Optica, a reconnaissance aeroplane that was being developed by FLS at that time at Bournemouth. Various other aeroplanes, most of which were not worth talking about. But if you are a professional test pilot, what interests you is the test program that needs to be done. It isn't a case of, it's not interesting if the thing doesn't fly at Mach 2, 50 feet upside down in the middle of the night. Any time you get into an aeroplane, whether you're going to test it or just use it, you can kill yourself. And you can kill yourself if you make a mistake, and the aeroplane can kill you if the wing comes off or whatever. So professional test pilots have the greatest respect for all aeroplanes, and it's got nothing to do with their maximum speed, which is what most people think. So I flew a lot of general aviation aeroplanes in that time and so on, and I think probably the program that gave me the most satisfaction ever in my whole flying career was not the Harrier, but the CN-235 out in Indonesia. And that may seem a funny thing to say, but one of the problems with being a test pilot on the Harrier was that if you had a point of view and you wanted to make a change to the aeroplane, then you wouldn't necessarily be allowed to do it. Money might get in the way, office politics might get in the way, the not invented here might get in the way, all of these things. Now, I have to say that 9 times out of 10, because of the quality of the relationship between Kingston and its test pilots, we got our way. But nevertheless, there was a lot of frustration in the program at times. The effort you had to make to argue for a change and so on, which seemed, the reason seemed self-evident. And then you had to go to the ministry and get the money and all that. When I was doing the CN-235 program out in Indonesia, it was a modest enough aeroplane, didn't go faster than about 250 knots. But I was in total charge of the whole program for 3 months. Anything I wanted to do was done. Anything I wanted was paid for. Any change I wanted to make. In other words, I wasn't just the test pilot on the program. I was the program manager. I was in charge. I had an authority that, in my view, was commensurate with my responsibility. When you fly a Harrier, you have a lot of responsibility to bring back this very expensive piece of kit and not break it and so on. But you often don't have the authority commensurate with that responsibility once you're on the ground again. You can normally get your own way in the air, but on the ground, you... So, but it wasn't like that in Indonesia. And so for me, as a sort of contract test pilot, it was a brilliant experience, and I really enjoyed my time there.
And since ending your period as a contract test pilot, have you kept your hand in?
Not really. I occasionally fly in multi-crew airplanes. I don't have a license now from a medical point of view. I haven't done any real test flying now for a couple of years. That's it. I'm 74 now, so what sort of thing? You've got to give up sooner or later. I had a good time. Very good time. Very interesting period in aviation. Awful lot going on. And I feel in many ways quite sorry for the youngsters today doing the job that I did, because they don't have so many opportunities to them, available to them. But then, of course, they only know what they know, and so you don't miss what you have no experience of, really. When wandering around an airfield at Farnborough in 1950 and seeing 106 different types of aeroplane, you know, that was how I started my career, and I don't think it could have been better in any way, shape or form than it was.
Thank you very much, Jim.